What time is it? Yeah, I can imagine. I've heard it all growing up. Sorry, I lost track of the time. Is there a lot of reverb on this? Is it loud or? See, normally I have all this all figured out before I get up here. Are we okay? Does it sound weird? Are we all right? Hi, I'm Rob. And I'm late, yes. If you have a Bible, if you want to open it to Esther chapter 2. We're looking at the book of Esther. We decided to come to the book of Esther because this continues the story of the Jewish people who were still in captivity, still part of the group that had been taken away into Babylon and who stayed there even after the Jewish people began to re-inhabit the Promised Land. So a whole group of people have already gone over to the Promised Land, but this is the story of the people who stayed behind, who decided they were going to have their life there in Persia. What the story of Esther is basically the origins of the holiday, the Jewish holiday of Purim. And that's what this is basically going to be telling us, the whole origins of that holiday. As we open the book, we saw that the king of Persia, who we believe is Xerxes, he goes by a different name under this text, but he was throwing a party. Remember, it was like a 6-month-long party, and then he had another 7-day party, and he had called for the queen to come, and he was going to show off how beautiful she was, but she didn't show up. She snubbed his invitation, and so then he got angry, and they made a decree, and she was deposed from being the queen. And so that's kind of, you know, we know that he had gone off to fight against the Greeks in an interim period here. So it comes to the point in time where he's feeling bad. He felt bad that he had done all that to Vashti, and his advisors could tell that he was probably getting close to maybe, you know, reversing this law that he had made, which the Persians weren't supposed to do. So they said, well, let's go ahead and do what we said we were going to do. Let's have this contest. Let's round up all the prettiest girls in Persia and see if we can't find you a new king. Queen, rather. Whole different lifestyle. So that's where we left off. They were going around and they were going to do that. They were going to find all the pretty girls in Persia. So we left off with verse 5. We finished off with verse 4, so we'll pick up in verse 5 of Esther chapter 2, because now we're going to be introduced to really what is our main characters. It says, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Yair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Yeconiah or Jehoiakim, either word name you want to use, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Okay, so here, this is our introduction to what will be our main characters as we go through the rest of this, the ones that we'll be focused on mostly. Here in this royal setting, you know, we spend the whole first chapter in the midst of all this royalty and all these amazing world shakers, you know, the guy that went off and fought the Grecian wars and everything, and now all of a sudden our setting changes and we find these two commoners who are going to get swept up into a world that's so far outside of what they've known on their own. They're going to be caught up into a world of political intrigue and power plays and lawmaking. And while the story is romantic to a degree, it is not a romance story. And romance is not at the center of this. And I hate to disappoint everybody, but actually the center of this story deals with issues of destiny and survival. And as we've stated before, this is an interesting book because God will never be directly mentioned, nor will he be directly appealed to in this book as we continue the story on it. But we'll still see by inference that God's at work in doing certain things. So Mordecai and his cousin were from a family that were taken in the first wave of exiles that left Jerusalem during the Babylonian siege. So he and his cousin, he and Hadassah, were probably second-generation Persians to this point. I mean, in terms of where they lived. They'd been living in Persia. They'd been born in Persia. This is all they ever knew. This was home as far as they understood what home was supposed to be. We assume that Mordecai was an older cousin to Hadassah, hence he took this role of responsibility to look after her when her parents died. We don't know, maybe he made a promise to them or whatever, but obviously he cares about her. This is something that is important to him. Hadassah, the Jewish name for Esther, means myrtle, and that's a flower that grows on a shrub in the desert regions. Well, it grows all over the place, but it's got kind of a star-like flower that blossoms all over it. And so when we get to her Persian name, which is Esther, it actually, you can see, it means literally star, and we can kind of see the connection, why she would have gotten that name, because it is reminiscent of her Hebrew name. The text describes Esther as lovely and beautiful, but more literally, it actually says beautiful in form and lovely to look at. So in other words, her features, all of her physical features, fit the cultural ideals of beauty. You know, when they looked at her, I mean, we know what that's like. We've got cultural ideals of what beauty is supposed to be here in our world, in the place where we live. You know, in fact, that cultural ideal of beauty is something we're saturated in because of the media culture that we live in. But we have to remember that that's not what true beauty is, not based on what the Bible says, based on what Scripture reveals to us. That's the cultural ideal for what they consider to be pleasing to their own eyes and for their own purposes. But Proverbs 31:30 tells us, ladies, that's not the cultural ideal of beauty. Is not your end goal. That's not the thing you aspire to or try to achieve throughout your life. Proverbs 31:30: charm is deceitful, beauty is fleeting, but a woman who fears the Lord will be praised. And so, there's something much deeper than that. There's something much more important than just the ideals of beauty that any culture will embrace at the time. And I make it the distinction there, the cultural ideal, because I could almost guarantee you, if we could go back in time and look at what they were considering beautiful, we'd probably be shocked. We'd probably be like, what? So, I mean, you know, it's always going to change. That sort of thing is constantly in flux, and that's why it's fleeting. It's fleeting in its perception. It's fleeting because we can't maintain that forever, but that heart for the Lord, that character that's shaped according to the Lord's values, that's the thing that endures. That's what causes the real beauty to be able to radiate. And as we're going to see in this story, in actuality, all of the trouble that's going to begin here is going to begin because Esther is beautiful according to the values of that culture. Because, you know, everybody thinks she's hot, then everything's going to fall apart here. And we're going to see how this works here. So this is where we lead on to verse 8. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken into the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and she obtained his favor. So he readily gave beauty preparations to her besides her allowance. Then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. Esther had not revealed her people or family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. Okay, so Esther is taken into this thing, and we got to realize this is not, you know, this is not a contest like American Idol or something. This isn't something that the girls were all signing up for at a table in the gym somewhere. This, you know, you gotta think in terms of soldiers going through the streets and going door to door and asking to see the young girls, and you know, and the ones that they deemed were pretty were taken away. I mean, you know, taken from their homes, taken from their families, from their fathers and their mothers and their siblings and their friends. Friends under armed guard, taken away off to the palace. So this was not necessarily a good thing. There's nothing in this that indicates that this was something that was voluntary. And again, this is all because, you know, she's pretty enough to fit the criteria. I mean, she finds favor with Haggai. And you know, you'll read a lot of commentaries at times where people will try to infer in this that it was because she was so godly and righteous that it caused her to have favor with Haggai. But really, the text doesn't say that at all. The text actually just tells us that she was pretty. And I think it's a safer assumption to say that Haggai felt that she was the best chance among the lot to actually win this competition. He probably looked at her and said, this is probably going to be the one that the king is going to like, and I'm going to give special attention to that because that will ultimately give him favor with the king as she's, you know, brought in before the king. I guess what I want to make sure is that we don't overinflate Esther's virtue in this whole thing, because I think we could possibly miss the point of what this book is trying to reveal to us if we do that. It's not to say that God isn't in this. It's not to say that God isn't behind the favor that she's enjoying. I believe he is. I believe he is behind this, orchestrating these things. As I said, we're not going to find God overtly mentioned in any of these verses, but I believe he's inferred in this whole story, and I believe that he's even behind this aspect of things. But not because Esther is so godly and like a saint walking in there in the midst of this thing. It's you know, she's just pretty. Now, a mysterious aspect of this that really prompts a lot of questions and has prompted questions for years, I mean, throughout the ages, is the question of why did Mordecai tell Esther to keep her Jewish heritage secret? You know, immediately we might want to jump to the end of the story if you're familiar with it, and we think, you know, well, you know, it was dangerous. But actually, at this point of in time in the story, there was no threat indicated against the Jewish people. There was no real overt reason as to why she had to keep her Jewish identity a secret, why she had to hide that. People have puzzled over that for years. Now, here are the more popular suggestions that are possibilities. The first one is because Mordecai thought that she might be disqualified from this contest because she was Jewish. You know, there probably would have been a prejudice against those people who were, you know, brought in as exiles. And even though they've been nationalized by the Persians, we don't really want their kind around here. So she might have just been booted out of the contest. The reason that one doesn't really totally fit is because there's no indication that she wanted to be in this contest in the first place. There's no indication that Mordecai wanted her in the contest. The very fact that it says she is taken to the palace indicates something different. If we assign to Mordecai the ambition that he wants to keep her secure or possibly win this, we're assigning to Mordecai kind of a character flaw than I think is necessarily fair. The other supposition is that maybe he wanted her to be able to observe the law. You know, things like dietary habits and keeping the Sabbath and things like that he you know, told her to keep that secret so that she could observe those things secretly, because if it were known, then the palace could force her to actually do these things, to eat stuff off of the royal table or whatever that she didn't want to necessarily do. Again, that one's a little dicey because the text doesn't indicate that. When that sort of thing was happening in Daniel, I mean, it was right out in the open. They said, we're not going to do this because we don't want to violate what God said. So, you know, there's nothing like that in this. The third one of the, I mean, there's a lot of different theories, but these are the three that stick out to me. The third one was the idea that that Mordecai, in verse 11 there, says was keeping watch on her. You know, you think about this. Now, that little bit right there kind of tells us a lot about their relationship, doesn't it? I mean, they take her off. They take her away from his house, and he doesn't just, you know, kick back in the recliner and say, oh, well, that's too bad. I hope she's okay. No, he follows her. He goes to where she's taken. Now, obviously, she's going to be segregated from him. He can't get to her, but he gets as close to her as he possibly can. He's in the courtyard out there near the place so that he can talk to people that can go in and out and try to get secret messages to her to keep tabs on her, to find out if she's okay. And this makes sense to me that it could very well be because, you know, the Jews have traditionally been mistreated by other cultures that he didn't know. It was more out of the idea that he didn't know what her fate would be if they found out that she was Jewish. Maybe they'd mistreat her. Maybe they'd harm her in some way. So the best thing, the best course of action, as he could see it, would be just keep it mum. Keep it quiet. Don't let anybody know. And then we'll see how this pans out. We'll see what happens here and see if you're going to be okay. Because he had no idea if she was going to make it through. That seems to make sense, especially when it's supported by the idea of verse 11, that he's there watching over her. I guess, you know, we'll never know for sure what the reasons are because the text doesn't tell us. So these are all things that we just speculate. We wonder. I mean, I like the idea that he cared about her enough that he was going to watch over her. Verse 12, each young woman's turn came to go to the king. Is that where I'm supposed to be? Yeah, it came to Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus there were the days of their preparation apportioned, 6 months with oil and myrrh, and 6 months with perfume, and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. And he's going to take whatever props or whatever, I don't know. But verse 14, and then in the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Shaagaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go to the king again unless he delighted in her and called her by name. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go to the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebet, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown upon her head, and he made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, a feast of Esther, for all his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. Okay, so all the girls were given this year-long spa treatment, basically, to get prepared for this, and at the end of this, they would go spend a night with a king. And if he liked her, well, he'd give her a call in the morning. If not, she was shipped off to another part of the harem, and it was the part of the harem of the concubines, which was not a good thing. These were not wives. These were women who were just kept by the king. They didn't enjoy the luxury of being a wife or anything like that. They were segregated from all other men, but they still belonged to the king. And so, you know, their fate really was a horrible fate when you look at it like that. I mean, certainly they were surrounded by the luxury of the palace, but they were never going to know a relationship with a husband. They were never going to have that aspect of their life fulfilled. They were just, at the beck and call of the king, if he so desired. And when you figure a king who's got a gigantic harem, I mean, that day may never come. I mean, it never could, you know, so it is not a good fate for the women who didn't make the cut. But Esther's time with the king rolls around, and she goes to the palace, and it says that the king loved her more. The idea is that, you know, her beauty dazzled him. And so she obtained grace, and she obtained favor from him, and she's crowned as Miss Persia, and she's made queen, and then she even gets a national holiday named after her. So it's Queen Esther Day all through Persia, and everybody's happy and having a good time. So clearly, I mean, God is at work in all of this. I mean, I'm pointing towards the things that the text points out as being the reason for the favor that she's got. But obviously, God's working in these things. God's orchestrating things. These are people who had determined that they were going to make their home in Persia, outside of God's promised land, outside of what God's purposes were for the nation of Israel. They were going to try to find a life in this world, and things are working towards the result of looking for that life in this world. So God in his mercy, God in his care and his love is still working behind the scenes, working in events to watch out for and to take care of the people that he loves. So this actually, in a lot of ways, when you think about it, this story kind of mirrors Joseph's story and Moses' story, how, you know, they're taken into a foreign nation, they're taken in by foreign royalty and given favor and used by God because of the position that they're in. Well, Moses not so much. Moses actually didn't become the rescuer of the Israelites until he was out of favor with the royalty there, but either way. Okay, verse 19, when virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now Esther had not revealed her family and her people just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. In those days, while Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on gallows, and it is written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Okay, not sure what this second gathering of virgins is all about, round two. I don't know. I don't know exactly. Nobody seems to know what that was all about. But either way, his attention is occupied elsewhere. And so we see that during this period of time, Mordecai is sitting in the gate of the king. Now, again, you know, I'm just going to throw out all the different theories on this. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about this. When you use a phrase like sitting in the king's gate like this, that could either be that he's still just hanging out, you know, as close to Esther as he can. He's basically just camping out there, just hanging out there every day, you know, to try to be there or to take care of her as best as he can. Some it infer that it means a position of influence, that he got himself promoted in some way as a city official, because to be in the city gate, to sit in the city gate, oftentimes is referring to somebody who is a civil authority, a civil leader in some way. So some people think that it could be that. Others think that maybe that he got a job doing something around the city gate, you know, doing something around the palace grounds. Either way, again, we don't know exactly for sure, but somehow, some way, he's able to be privy to a conspiracy that's beginning to brew between two men who are eunuchs, who are servants of the king's. They're all of a sudden angry at him, and they decide that they're wanting to assassinate him. Now, this fits in nicely with the historic context of the thing, because we know that was true of Xerxes. He was facing rebellions on a regular basis. When he came back from the Grecian campaign, he had gone to Babylon and destroyed their golden image to Bel. And so all the Babylonians in the region who would have been there in that region hated him, hated Xerxes. In fact, ultimately, 20 years into his reign, Xerxes actually is assassinated, most believe, under his son's influence. His son desired to have him assassinate Artaxerxes. So anyway, so this fits in nicely. We see that, you know, this sort of thing was happening in history, that there were a lot of rebellions that were going on, and so he wasn't necessarily liked. He's always painted in a very favorable light by, you know, Jewish rabbis and even by the scriptures itself. He's never necessarily painted that much of a bad guy, and mostly that's because he's allowed the Jews to go back, and as we'll see in this story, he, but anyway, so I don't want to get ahead of myself. So anyway, he finds out that there's this conspiracy. These guys are going to try to kill him. So he sends word to Esther somehow. I don't know if he folds a paper airplane and throws it through the window or something. Gets a message to her saying that the king king's going to be assassinated. And again, we have to wonder about this. What's his motives on this? Why is he doing this? Is he just such a loyal citizen that he cares so much about the king, he just wants to make sure he's okay? Or is he thinking, my little cousin's in there, my little cousin's in this palace, and if there's an assassination and there's a coup and all the outbreak of violence that comes from that, maybe she won't be safe, so I need to let her know. He doesn't necessarily tell her to go tell the king or anything like that. He just lets her know. But she does the smart thing and lets the king know. And when they investigate the matter, they find out, yeah, these guys were up to no good. And so, it says they're hung on the gallows. The translation of that is a little bit wonky. I mean, more than likely, because the Persians were using a primitive form of crucifixion at that time, more than likely that's what they're talking about. They hung them up on something for a slow and gruesome death that was common to them at this time. The Assyrians were some of the first to pioneer this sort of thing. So for all of his good efforts, though, Mordecai, you know, she sends this message in the name of Mordecai to the king, and for all of his good efforts, all this, you know, he saved the king, and you know, what's he get out of it? Well, he gets a little byline in the king's history journal, but that's it, you know, no grand parade, no nothing nice. I mean, in a lot of ways, you kind of feel like that's a bit of a slight, kind of an oversight to this heroic thing that this guy did. And even there, it's one of the things about this story is that God shows up in all the blank spaces in this, all the things that aren't happening, all the things that we don't see going on. We infer that God is at work doing the things that he's doing. And even in this thing that could have felt like a terrible insult, I believe God's at work because it's going to come into play at a later date. And so we continue on here, chapter 3. It says, after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were within the city, in the king's gate, said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily that he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai had told them that he was a Jew. Well, now, this is really interesting. Okay, all the different things in this. All of a sudden, Haman comes on the scene. Who? I mean, this is the first we heard of him in this story, and now we find out that not only, you know, is he kind of important, but he's clearly got the favor of the king. The king's promoted him, but we don't have any information of how he rose to power or got the king's favor. The only thing that we're told is his background. He is an Agagite, which means he's from the Amalekites. Back in 1 Samuel 15, King Saul, who was a Benjamite, like Mordecai was, Kish, who was a father of Mordecai, was also in the lineage of Saul. So even Mordecai finds himself in the lineage of Saul. Saul was commanded to kill King Agag, and he failed to do that. He didn't kill him. And the Amalekites were a thorn in the side, were at odds with the Israelites forever. I mean, all through the ancient history, those two never reconciled. They were bitter enemies towards each other at all times. And so here we've got this strange connection here of a descendant of Agag and a descendant of Saul, who are fit in juxtaposition within this story all of a sudden. That's what we know. The Amalekites, the sworn enemy of Israel, this rivalry between these two races of people that had been there for all this time. And then we see this other aspect where Mordecai wouldn't bow or pay respect to the newly promoted Haman. Now, I would say a good majority of commentators, as you read them, will try to connect this, the fact that he doesn't bow to Haman, they'll try to connect this with the book of Daniel. Because what does it sound like right off the bat? Doesn't it? It sounds like the three Hebrew children who wouldn't bow and, you know, got in trouble because of it. But we really can't make that connection like that, because in that case, in Daniel, in the book of Daniel, the three Hebrew children who wouldn't bow were refusing to bow to an image which they were told to worship. There's actually nothing in Jewish law, there's nothing that God ever said that prohibited the Jewish people from paying honor to a king, from bowing before a king or bowing before a ruler. In fact, Jeremiah, when the exiles were going out, Jeremiah prophesied to the Jewish people and said, honor the king while you're there. Just plant your crops, do what you're supposed to do, get along and you'll have peace and everything will be okay. So this is kind of a strange thing because there's nothing in this text that indicates at all that this was something that they were supposed to be bowing down to him as though he's a god. They're just supposed to be bowing before him because of his elevated status as a ruler among these people, to show that kind of respect, that sort of honor to Haman. And it's an interesting thing that all of a sudden he isn't willing to do this. You know, we're not told in this that when they ask him, why are you not going to do this? He doesn't come back and say, well, because I'm not going to give honor to a man that only belongs to God. I'm going to serve God. I'm loyal to my God. No, he doesn't say that at all. Anybody catch? What did he say when they ask him, why won't you do it? What is it? Because I'm Jewish. Well, that's the only two things that are brought up in this text. You've got an Amalekite, people who are at complete odds with the Jews, and you've got a Jewish guy over here being told you need to give honor to this guy. This isn't an issue of great nobility and godliness on Mordecai's part. This is a racial issue. This is prejudice. He's looking at this guy and saying, I'm not going to bow before an Amalekite. Are you crazy? I'm not. It's like an FSU fan saying, I'm not going to give homage to a Gator or vice versa. You know, that sort of kind of thing. I mean, it's one of these things. It's just out of human pride. It's out of this kind of attitude. Like, I'm better than this guy. I'm not going to bow to this guy. And when they say, why aren't you doing this? He goes, because I'm Jewish. You know, it's the same thing that we see happening over there today. The Jews and the Palestinians, they're at odds with each other. They're not going to honor each other. They're not going to look after each other that way. And that, to me, is the basis. If we're going to go purely by what the text is telling us, not all the stuff that we try to infer, not all the different things, the connections that we try to make that aren't necessarily there. See, we got a real problem about going in and trying to make God's word respectable. We got a problem with wanting to make sure that we make this godly enough to pass God's muster when he's the one who inspired it. He put it here for a reason. And I believe the reasons are here if we'll pay attention to it. This wasn't inspired by his great stand of faith. This was inspired because he was stubborn and did not like those people. He didn't like them. Well, man, Rob, this doesn't sound, you know, very godly or honorable. No, it's not. It's what's so cool about it. But anyway, okay, so we move on. Verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, which is the lot, or dice, you know, before Haman to determine the day and the month until it fell on the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. Okay, so he looks at this and he's mad about this. He's thinking, you know, this guy not giving me honor. What's really interesting to me is obviously he didn't notice any of this until somebody brought it to his attention. Yeah, he was happily going along thinking everybody thought he was cool until somebody said, by the way, did you notice that guy? He's not bound. Woo. And so then he looks at this and then he's thinking, well, I don't like this. And clearly we see the whole racial issue here, because all of a sudden it's not just a matter of I'm going to get even with this guy who's disrespecting me. I'm going to get rid of those people who have always been disrespecting our people. And so this is his attempt at trying to take care of that once and for all. I'm going to get rid of all of these people. And then we'll see, you know, when I eradicate them all, then we'll see who the superior race is. So it's an interesting development that we see here. And he uses a dice, basically. They cast lots out to make this decision. In other words, this is his means of looking to. Even here, we're not going to even mention the foreign gods to this degree. It's almost like a level of fate, but he's going to, you know, it's inferred in that he's, you know, wanting the, you know, the powers, the whatever powers that rule the universe in his perspective, to show him when the best time for doing this is going to be. And so they cast the lots And it comes down on the 12th month. Now, this is taking place. At the time that they're doing this in the first month. So that means there's 11 months that they've got to try to make preparations to go ahead and pull this thing off to where they're going to eradicate an entire race of people. And again, like we said, this is not God mentioned directly, but it's inferred that, you know, his hand is the hand that's turning that lot to determine the time that this is going to be, because while it gives them 11 months to make the preparations, it also gives 11 months for something to change in this, to where the Jewish people are going to be spared and they're not going to be facing the fate that Haman would like them to face. And of course, I'm not trying to get ahead of myself, and if you haven't read the story, you'll find out how this goes. But the needed time that would be there, if the Jews are going to escape, that needed time was provided just in this simple thing that he did. Instead of saying, well, let's do this now, let's rush with this, let's go with this while we're, you know, energized about it, instead he decides to throw this out there. And, you know, Proverbs 16:33 says, a lot is cast, but every decision is from the Lord. In other words, you know, men can try to leave these things up to fate, but God is working out his purposes. And I'm just someone who believes in the sovereignty of God. My interpretation, my understanding of what sovereignty means to me means that man can make all the free choices that he wants. He's absolutely free to make whatever free choice he wants to make. But God is so sovereign that he can work even through all of the crazy things that we determine to still perfect and bring his will to complete perfection and finish it his way. And so we can cast a lot. We can try to leave things up to fate, but God is the one who makes the final decisions on all these things. And so the Lord works this out. You know, it's not mentioned directly, but he works it out to where it's going to be 11 months from this time before anything happens. So verse 8, then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there are certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other people's, and they do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for her king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries. Yeah? So the king took his signet ring from his hand and he gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the money and the people are given to you to do with them as seems good to you. Then the king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month, and a decree was written according to all that Haman commanded. To the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, to the officials of all the people, to every province according to its script, and to every people in their language. In the name of King Ahasuerus it was written and sealed with the king's signet ring, and the letters were sent by couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their possessions. A copy of the document was to be issued as law in every province, being published for all people, that they should be ready for that day. The couriers went out, hastened by the king's command, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan, the citadel. So the king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed or in confusion. Okay. So Haman goes to the king and he plies him with half-truths. You know, well, there are these certain people, but you notice that he leaves out what people? You notice that he didn't say the Jews or the Jewish people or anything like that. He leaves that little bit of information out. There are these people. They're rebellious people. You know, well, no, not necessarily, although they did rebel against the Babylonian Empire, so I guess you could say that it's kind of true. They've got their own laws. Well, yeah, they kind of do have their own way of doing things. They refuse to obey the king. Well, not necessarily. I mean, they weren't always supposed to be, but, you know, you could see where he's using all of these things, these bits of information, using them to his own advantage to paint a picture, an incorrect picture before the king to persuade the king to adopt them as a common enemy. The easiest way to unite any people is to devise a straw man enemy, is to create an enemy that we've all got to unite against, that we recognize is out there to get us. You know, we can call it whatever we want to. The church is famous for this. We'll create all kinds of enemies to get ourselves united together when we were supposed to be united over the love love of one king. But either way, and so that's what he does here. He gives these two incentives to the king. He basically lets him know that you know, you're going to be rid of all these rebels. If you agree to do this with me, you'll have all these rebels out of your land, and also you're going to get all kinds of money from this, because we're going to plunder them, and then every bit of money that comes in, I'm going to put in your treasury. So it's a win-win for you, king. Let's go with this. And so the king, you know, clearly not thinking this through, or not really paying enough of attention. I mean, you know, you would think that even a reasonable person would say, what people? But either way, he gives him his ring, gives him the go-ahead. And this is an astounding decree that he issues here. I mean, as you're reading it over, it's alarming as you look at it. I mean, can you imagine being a Jewish person and going out and seeing that? Now, the Jewish people have faced that over and over and over again throughout history. And there are reasons for that, because the enemy will never make allowances for people who God has declared belong to him. But this is legalized genocide. I mean, he's giving license to kill the entire race of Jewish people. I mean, you talk about Final Solution. This is where you find the origins of it right there. This is the permission for all the people, because it's even saying so that everybody's ready. In other words, all the people of all the provinces, of all the town have got to get ready, because we're going to have one big day where we're going to kill everybody. And the thing about this is, and the thing that suddenly makes you kind of go, oh, and step back for a moment, as you realize that the people who've returned to the promised land, the Jewish people who've now inhabited Jerusalem, are still in that territory that belongs to King Ahasuerus. So that includes all of those people who've gone back to Jerusalem. And if Israel is wiped out, where does the Messiah come from? So suddenly, the scope of this thing has been enlarged. What started off as kind of a prejudice kind of thing about, I'm not bowing to you and you're not going to take care of me, has fanned out to being a gigantic conspiracy by the enemy to thwart God's purposes and his plans. But God is never going to be thwarted. God's plans never come to nothing. When he decrees a thing and he's determined that he'll do it, it will be done. And so God is in control, and no matter how bad it looks at this situation, because it doesn't look like he even seems to be around based on the text, he's still at work, he's still going to do something, and we'll see how that all pans out. So king seems to be ignorant of how serious this is. He and Haman head back to the bar to go drinking again, and the whole city of Shushan, it says, is, you know, the whole capital city is in confusion. Everybody's running around trying to figure out what's happening. So we'll see where the story goes after that. So Father, we thank you for your word, and Lord, we thank you that the people that you provided for us in the Bible aren't superheroes, aren't anything beyond what we know in our own experience. Are people who sometimes have faulty motives, people who oftentimes are selfish, and yet your grace and your love comes through, your determination to care for and preserve and protect those whom you love is a wonderful thing to behold. And Father, I just pray that for us, we take comfort from that. In those times in our own life when it feels like the decrees are written and everything's set against us, we can remember that you're in control, that you have a plan and a purpose. No matter how things may go for us, no matter what we understand, we can know that you care, that your plan and your purpose is for our best. So help us to rest in that and follow that example. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.